Noriega and Hussein have the following in common. They are living proof that the United States no longer has to search the world for enemies. They are the proof that we are now investing in their development. Both Noriega, of course, was working, and Hussein were close allies of the United States. Noriega working with the CIA very closely in Panama, and Hussein supported by the United States all through the 1980s in his war with Iran. Well, I mention Hussein because I want to make some comments on the Gulf crisis and the war, something that you're not going to find in the straight media or the so-called mainstream U.S. media. We all know really why, or the official interpretation or reasons of why the United States went into this war. We were responding on moral principle, on political principle. We were preserving our way of life, our access to the petroleum resources of the Persian Gulf. I remember at one point James Baker made the comment that jobs are at stake with the Hussein takeover of Kuwait. There were a lot of different stories put out over the months before the shooting war started, especially before the UN resolution at the end of November, giving Hussein until January 15th to move out of Kuwait or else force would be used. Well, there's an alternative interpretation. This is the interpretation that is founded on the belief that the Bush administration, that is the president and his very closest advisors, had determined that a world crisis was needed in order to replace the 40-odd-year-old crisis in Western Europe, that is the Soviet threat, which had largely disappeared with the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and with the chaos that has followed in the Soviet Union. This crisis in Western Europe was used, you know, for more than 40 years, at least since 1950, to justify the permanent war economy in the United States. That is, having military spending as the motor of the U.S. economy. It wasn't this way always, but today we have that as a reality, and we've had it for quite some time. The official figure, you know, for military spending in the United States, that is last year, was that 26% of the budget went to defense or military. But in that calculation of 26%, they don't include a lot of things which are extremely important, such as interest on the national debt from past military expenditures, the retirement programs for tens of thousands of former Department of Defense employees, a whole series of categories of military-related activities, but which are not included in order to keep that figure down to 26%. Analysts estimate that the figure for military spending is far more than 50% of the national budget, of the federal budget. Some people, like Gore Vidal, put it at two-thirds of the national budget as going for defense-related activities. Well, this had its beginning back in 1950. It was the application of or increase in military expenditures in order to resolve economic problems at home. During those first 5 years after the end of World War II in 1945 to 1950, the United States economy, the GNP, had declined by 20%, and unemployment had gone from nearly nothing, that is 700,000, to something like 4.7 million. In Washington, at the highest levels, this was the Truman administration time, at the highest levels, there was extreme fear that the United States was going to return to the condition of the Great Depression of the 1930s. In order to avoid that, the decision was taken to rearm the United States and Western Europe. That is, it would be financed by U.S. taxpayers through the federal government. It wasn't initially successful. The outline for this program and the world analysis which contained it was a top-secret document for 25 years, and only in 1975 was it, by accident, declassified and made public. It was a mistake on the part of the government. They wanted to keep it secret, and someone made a terrible mistake. But the document is known as NSC 68. And it was prepared by Paul Nitze, who was then the chief of the policy planning staff of the Department of State. Paul Nitze, the same Paul Nitze who in the 1980s was one of the chief disarmament advisors to President Reagan and Vice President Bush then. Well, this document, in the version I have, which was published in the Naval War College Review, runs to about 50 pages, I think. And it is an entire analysis of the whole world, the East-West problems, and of the U.S. economy. And the key phrase from that document was this: the United States and other free nations will, within a period of a few years at most, experience a decline in economic activity of serious proportions unless more positive governmental programs are developed. Well, the solution adopted, the more positive governmental programs, was expansion of the military. The problem was, this is early 1950, but the problem was that the Congress would not give Truman the additional billions of dollars that he wanted for this new program, the program outlined in NSC 68. That was because it was unpopular, people didn't want to pay all those taxes that it would require, and it would require something like tripling or quadrupling the military budget. He could not get the money from Congress, and the only way he finally got it was through the Korean War. And the similarities between what has happened in the Gulf, 1990, 1991, and what happened in Korea in 1950 are really very striking. Many of you don't or won't recall what happened in Korea, but in June of 1950, the North Korean forces entered from the north to the south. Korea as a country had been split. It had been partitioned and divided at the 38th parallel by the United States and the Soviet Union in 1945. It had been occupied for a couple of generations by the Japanese. And with the defeat of the Japanese, the Soviets entered in the north, the United States entered from the south, and in agreement between the two countries, Korea was supposedly temporarily divided at the 38th parallel. And the United States set up a dictatorship, really, in the south, and the Soviets set up a government in the north, a communist government. Well, it was the communist troops who moved to the south in June 1950, and these South Korean forces retreated, more or less inviting them to follow them south. In the United Nations, just as in the case of the Gulf, the United States obtained a series of resolutions through the UN Security Council, formed a coalition of military forces, with the United States providing probably 98% or 95% of the coalition, to restore independence to South Korea and to expel the North Koreans from South Korea. This had been achieved by September of 1950. But Truman decided to go far beyond the provisions of the UN Security Council resolutions. He should have stopped, according to those resolutions, at the 38th parallel. That would have been the end of it. North Korea would have been expelled from the South, and the military action would have ended. But Truman had another plan. In order to get his programs of NSC 68, the rearmament programs in the U.S. and Western Europe, through Congress, he decided to invade North Korea. And he did this in early October of 1950, advancing rapidly to the north toward the Yalu River, which is the boundary between China, which had been taken over by the communists the year before, and North Korea. The Chinese communists warned that if they didn't stop heading toward China, that China would enter the war. They did not stop, that is, the U.S. didn't stop, and the Chinese did enter the war. They poured hundreds of thousands, eventually a million troops across the border into North Korea to stop the United States there, and by November, U.S. troops were retreating to the south, and the U.S. media was full of pictures and stories about the U.S. soldiers and Marines retreating through ice and snow before these advancing hordes of communist Chinese troops. I remember it very well. I was in high school then. Well, the war went on for three more years after it could have stopped. As a result, there were something like 34,000 Americans killed in that war. More than 100,000 were wounded, and the entire toll of the war was measured in the the millions. But it did provide Truman with the leverage he needed to get rearmament through Congress. As a result of his manipulation of the Korean War, U.S. military expenditures expanded really quite dramatically. For example, as a matter of fact, what Truman did was, in early December, he went on national radio and he declared a state of national emergency. And his Bush's words about our way of life being at stake are what reminded me of what Truman had said back in 1950. He went on national radio, mustered all the hype and emotion he could. He said, "Our homes, our nation, all the things that we believe in are in great danger. This danger comes or has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union." He also called again for massive increases in military spending for U.S. and European forces, quite apart from the needs in Korea. Well, by this time and in the weeks following, Congress did agree. As a result, during the first 2 years after 1950, U.S. military spending more than tripled from $13 billion to $44 billion. And the forces, the people in the military, more than doubled to 3.6 million. This was the beginning of the militarism that has followed without restraint for 41 years now. And it was all based on the so-called Soviet threat. There was no Soviet threat in 1950 when Truman attributed the Korean War to the Soviets. That was a ruse in order to create emotional hysteria, a false threat, and to get the leverage over Congress needed for those military programs. And the whole military program then is what some people call military Keynesianism, which is massive government spending on military programs in order to generate activity in the economy. The problem in those days was that Western Europe could not import sufficiently from the United States in order to sustain the U.S. economy. There weren't enough dollars in Europe. It was a so-called period of the so-called dollar gap. And so this whole U.S. financing of the remilitarization of Western Europe was done through what they called defense support grants. And this money, in turn, generated the exports from the United States to Western Europe that would then sustain the U.S. economy. This is what we've been living ever since, and it's the reason why I say that this crisis in Western Europe that has now largely disappeared, the East-West dimension of the Cold War, needed another crisis if the military spending within the United States was to be continued. And I think that Bush very likely saw the crisis area as the Persian Gulf. What better place could he find than the region where something like 65% of the world's petroleum resources are located? Hussein happened to be just the right guy for this crisis. You know that the United States supported Hussein all through his war with Iran. The CIA gave him the real-time military intelligence on the movements of Iranian military units for assistance to the Iraqi army. The United States became Iraq's largest trading partner with billions and billions of dollars of credits, official credits from agencies like the Export-Import Bank in Washington, in order to provide exports from the United States to Iraq. There were all of these different programs in which the United States was going all out to support Saddam Hussein. Why? Because Hussein at that time was serving as a buffer in his war against Iran. He was preventing the spread of Islamic fundamentalism into the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, keeping in mind that Iran is not an Arab country. But they were very active in trying to foment fundamentalist rebellion through the Shiite populations of the Arab Persian Gulf countries. And so the United States, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia all supported Iraq in the war with Iran. How could this crisis be created through Hussein? Well, one of the ways was to make Hussein think that he could take over Kuwait with impunity. It was quite well known in Washington that Iraq had a long historical claim on Kuwait. Kuwait had, in fact, for centuries belonged to the southern province of Iraq, the Basra province. That was under the Turkish Ottoman Empire. But with the collapse of the Turks after World War I, the French and the British moved into those areas of the Arab world that the Turks had controlled through its empire before. The French mostly into Lebanon and Syria, but the British moved in a very big way in the Persian Gulf. And in 1922, Sir Percy Cox, the British High Commissioner in Baghdad, drew for the first time in history the lines in the sand delineating the borders between Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. And in so doing, he drew the line in purposely, the documentation later proved it, he drew the line purposely to deprive Iraq of a viable seaport on the Persian Gulf. Their only seaport of any importance would be Basra, which is about 60 miles up the Shatt al-Arab, the estuary of the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. Well, the Iraqis never recognized formally the separation of Kuwait from the southern province. And that was one of the historical claims that Hussein had had and the Iraqis had had all along. In 1961, when the British, who had created no less than 10 colonies in the Persian Gulf, including Kuwait, in the 20s, when in 1961 the British gave independence to Kuwait, the Iraqis massed troops along the border with Kuwait, threatening to take the territory back by force, and the British then rushed military forces to Kuwait and the Iraqis backed down. But the Iraqis threatened to do the very same thing in 1972 and 1976. So there is this long, fairly long historical claims that the Iraqis have had on Kuwait for since the 1920s. But there were more immediate grievances as well. One was Kuwaiti overproduction, which had forced the world oil price down, and it was strangling the Iraqi economy going into July of last year. Iraq had a debt of something like $80 billion from its war with Iran. Most of that was owed to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, which, as I said, had supported Iraq. The Iraqis wanted forgiveness of those loans. And the Kuwaitis wouldn't do it. There was also the question of overproduction, which I mentioned just a moment ago. In 1986, the OPEC countries had set $18 as the world price for oil, and they had set quotas for maintaining that price. But the Kuwaitis and the United Arab Emirates had for a long time been overproducing, which had forced the price way down to as low as $14 a barrel and $12 a barrel last June. Well, this was costing the Iraqis huge amounts of money, and they were they were being strangled economically because of that, and they could not even pay their debts. Well, this happened to be the best price that the Western industrialized countries like the United States had been getting in constant dollars for the past 40 years. That was another grievance. And the third grievance was the seaport question. Iraq for quite some time had been insisting that Kuwait lease to Iraq two small uninhabited islands called Bubiyan and Warba, which are at the very top of the Persian Gulf, and which are just across from the Iraqi-Kuwait border. And Kuwait refused to do that too. So that on August 1st, Kuwaiti and Iraqi negotiators met in Saudi Arabia. The Kuwaitis refused to compromise, and the next day Hussein invaded. What was the United States doing all this time? Well, very interesting, some of the things that have come out. In April of last year, and these are the indicators which suggest that the Bush administration needed this crisis and encouraged Hussein to think he could get away with invading Kuwait. In April, the Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East, John Kelly, testified before Congress about various affairs, and among other things, he asserted that the United States has no commitment to defend Kuwait. The Secretary of State in 1950, in January of that year, also had said, this was Dean Acheson, he had also said that the United States had no commitment to defend South Korea. He put South Korea outside the U.S. defense perimeter in Asia. Another similarity. In July, the OPEC oil ministers met in Geneva, and Iraq insisted on raising the price, and they agreed to raise it from 1986 to $21 last July. At that time, Iraq massed 30,000 troops on the Kuwaiti border to pressure Kuwait into accepting this demand for a higher price and also new quotas so that the price would be maintained worldwide. And Kuwait also agreed to stop overproducing, as did the United Arab Emirates. All this background is very important for understanding the U.S. position. Following that meeting in Geneva of the OPEC oil ministers, instead of withdrawing the troops from the border, since he got his way, Hussein more than tripled the troops to 100,000. July 25th, the U.S. ambassador met with Hussein for the first time in a long time. Her name is April Glaspie. She meets Hussein and, among other things, tells him this. And this comes from a transcript of the meeting, which apparently the Iraqis recorded in secrecy, but then made public. They transcribed it, and it was translated from English and Arabic. She said, "I have a direct instruction from Secretary of State Baker to emphasize to you," and this is almost word for word, "to emphasize to you that the United States has, quote unquote, no opinion on your disputes with Kuwait." She also said, "I have an instruction from President Bush to seek better relations with Iraq." For his part, Hussein told her in so many words that he was going to take extremely strong action against Kuwait because he said that the Kuwaitis were carrying out economic war against Iraq through their overproduction and their refusal to compromise on the other matters. Well, with 100,000 troops massed on the Kuwaiti border and the ambassador's meeting with the president, not one word was said of warning that he should not take action against Kuwait in terms of an invasion, because that's just what he was threatening to do. U.S. intelligence, the satellite reconnaissance, had all these units identified and located along the border. 2 days before the invasion, this Assistant Secretary of State, John Kelly, again testifies in Congress that the United States has no commitment to defend Kuwait. And at the same time, he had canceled a Voice of America broadcast, which would have stated that the United States would defend its friends in the Gulf, including Kuwait. That was canceled. Well, put all of those things together, and there was no warning from Bush at all. Our impression would have been that it was an enormous surprise. Well, it was no surprise at all. They knew it was coming. Senator Boren, who is chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has stated that the CIA, 5, 6, 7 days before the invasion, was predicting that it was going to happen at any minute. Well, during that week, between the ambassador's meeting with Hussein and the invasion on August 2nd, there were plenty of things that could have been done to stop it. And that is why I feel very strongly that those 100,000 to 200,000 Iraqis who are now dead, plus the Americans and others who've been killed, didn't have to die at all. This whole crisis and war could have been avoided if Bush had wanted to. During that week before the invasion, he could have called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council and resolutions warning what the consequences would be. He could have organized a multinational military force to send to Kuwait, just as the British had done back in 1961 when the Iraqis were threatening, at the time they gave Kuwait independence. There could have been public warnings. There were all sorts of things that could have happened during that week. But you know what Bush was doing? He was in Maine, boating, fishing, playing golf, demonstrating, I suppose you could say, that way of life that he said was at stake. Well, so much for the invasion. I think the war certainly could have been avoided. But there is another factor involved, too, and that is the North-South dimension of the Cold War. You've all heard that he's talking about a new international order or a new world order that should come out, that must come out of this Gulf crisis. Well, it seems to me that what he's talking about really is simply an institutionalization of the old North-South dimension of the Cold War. You know, most people, when speaking of the Cold War, would have thought U.S., NATO, Soviet, Warsaw Pact, Europe as the theater, and that that was really the Cold War, this standoff, this military standoff in Western Europe. Well, that was only a part of it. There was always a North-South dimension to the Cold War. This was the war against the so-called Third World for resources, for markets, and for labor. This is where the fighting actually took place, as in Vietnam. That, too, is a dimension of the Cold War that has been with us since the late 1940s. This is where I was working in the CIA, in the North-South dimension. I was in Latin America, and there was a Cold War going on there day and night, and that's what I was working in as a CIA officer. Well, it goes on still today. It hasn't diminished in the least. It continues with all its racist content, this North-South dimension. And that, in my interpretation, is what Bush wants to continue, because the U.S. is no less dependent on the importation of raw materials and products which we don't have ourselves than the United States was back in 1950. Well, the CIA, all through these years, these 40-odd years, in fact more now, it would be 44 years since the thing of the agency, was a major instrument, a very important instrument in the Cold War, both East-West and North-South. The CIA, for those who don't know, was established in 1947 under the National Security Act of that year. This law established the National Security Council, or NSC, as the highest policy-making body in matters of national security, defense, and foreign affairs. The same law is in effect today, and the National Security Council, according to the law, is chaired by the President of the United States. It has as statutory members the Vice President, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and several others of that very high level. The same law set up the CIA as the National Intelligence Agency, or National Intelligence Service, and as an instrument of the President and the National Security Council. The purpose? Intelligence service, obviously. But from the very beginning, the CIA did that, but much more. At the very first meeting of the National Security Council, this is October 1947, the month after Truman signs the law into effect, at the very first meeting of the NSC, the decision is taken to set aside $10 million to intervene secretly in these Italian elections coming up 6 months later. I mean to buy the elections. The elections were scheduled for April 1948. And starting in October, the CIA began to spend this money. They passed the money out through Italian-American organizations, through front organizations in Italy, and through the Vatican. And as a result, and all the money went to the Christian Democrats. The reason was that a coalition had been formed between communists and socialists, and these political forces had been the backbone of the resistance to more than 20 years of fascism in Italy. So they came out of World War II with great prestige and with a lot of strength. It was called the Popular Bloc. And the fear in Washington was that they would win those elections. It didn't matter to them that the Italian people should really decide. And so they went in and financed the Christian Democrats, who in the end, in April 1948, won very easily. But that wasn't the beginning and the end of the CIA subsidy to the Christian Democratic Party in Italy. During the next 25 years, the CIA passed out more than $100 million to the Christian Democrats in Italy. And they, ever since those first elections in 1948, they have dominated every single one of the many governments. I think it's more than 40 now. They're right now negotiating the formation of still another one. They have dominated every one of those governments, the Christian Democrats, not to be confused, they are a conservative, basically conservative party. Well, the agency was involved in all sorts of other activities such as that, which came to be known as covert action. Covert action is the way the CIA all through these years has intervened secretly in the affairs of other countries in order to influence the course of events in those countries. And this is all around the world. The agency also was called upon to foment or to mount paramilitary operations against Eastern Europe. These were done through the recruitment of refugees, so-called displaced persons, after World War II. They were interviewed in the camps in Western Europe, mostly in what became West Germany, and they were then selected and trained and dispatched back to every single one of the countries in Eastern Europe in order to carry out sabotage, to impede the reconstruction from the devastation of World War II, in order to foment rebellion, carry out assassinations, all kinds of things like that. Every single one of the Eastern European countries for 10 years at least, from about 1947 to 57, was the target of these operations. There were other operations such as the founding and or the establishment and manipulation and control of trade unions all over the world. Another area is media. Media operations in the CIA have been extremely important all through the years. These are operations in which the CIA pays a journalist, usually a foreign journalist, to publish the CIA's material as if it were the journalist's own. These operations have been vast. And all around the world where there are CIA operations, there is an officer in the CIA station or office who is in charge of media operations. Still another area, and this is where the CIA gets into very unpleasant or slimy activities, is in the liaison operations. Liaison operations are all those activities undertaken with a security or intelligence service of another country. These two had their beginning right at the beginning. The main liaison service with which the CIA worked at the beginning was the British intelligence service. They had, in fact, helped to found and train the World War II predecessor agency to the CIA called the Office of Strategic Services. Well, the British were a very important service for the CIA at the beginning. But early on, the agency began to establish the security and intelligence services of other countries. Greece was one of the first places they did this. There was a civil war in Greece, for those who don't know, 1947, 1949. Civil war between the conservative forces backed by the United States and Britain and the communists who had been the resistance forces to the Nazi occupation of Greece. The U.S. side won the war, and in the aftermath, the CIA set up a security service which was called the KYP, or KEEP, KYP being the Greek letters for CIA. They gave it the same name. And this security service was used by the CIA for about 20 years, really, to keep the conservatives in power in Greece. In 1967, when their power was threatened through upcoming elections, the CIA plotted with this local security service, which was quasi-military, and fomented a coup, a military coup, against the elected civilian government. That ushered in, or started, 7 years of military fascist dictatorship in Greece. It was known as the Colonel's Regime. And the very first president of this Colonel's Regime was George Papadopoulos, an army colonel, who had been the chief KYP liaison officer with the CIA station in Athens. There are many other examples. One could go all around the world, to Vietnam, to Latin America, where I did this work, to Africa, where the CIA has worked with these other security services. I'll give one recent example, and that is Honduras. In the early 1980s, the CIA established a unit of the Honduran Army called Battalion 106, I believe it was called. It was trained in Texas by the agency. This was then sent, people were sent back to Honduras, and there they became an official death squad in Honduras. They are responsible for the murder and disappearance of hundreds of people in Honduras during the 1980s. This has all been made public by lawsuits brought against the Honduran government by the survivors of these people who were murdered by this death squad set up by the CIA within the Honduran army. Their lawsuits, which were brought against Honduras in the Inter-American Court for Human Rights in San Jose, Costa Rica, that's the judicial arm of the Organization of American States. And in fact, these survivors have won a number of cases against the government, and the Honduran government has agreed to pay damages to the survivors. In 1954, to cite another type of operation, the CIA overthrew a democratically elected civilian government in Guatemala. And this was done in many other countries besides, but I want to mention Guatemala because it's very special. This was a reformist government who had carried out a series of reforms. Agrarian reform was one of them. And the CIA was called upon to overthrow that government because it had affected the agrarian reform, had affected the lands of the United Fruit Company based in Boston. And it happened that the law firm of the United Fruit was Sullivan and Cromwell, a Wall Street firm, which numbered among its partners John Foster Dulles, who at the time was Secretary of State, and Allen Dulles, his brother, who was the director of the CIA. The CIA, through deception operations and paramilitary operations, overthrew that government and established a military dictatorship in Guatemala that has continued to this day. There have been a number of civilian governments which have been figureheads, really, like the president who just left power, Cerezo, but the military has ruled Guatemala ever since the CIA's intervention in 1954. As a result, because of the agency's work with these security services in Guatemala, more than 100,000 people have been killed. I mean extrajudicially killed. They've been disappeared, they've been tortured to death, they've been murdered in one way or another, bodies thrown down on the highway, wherever. No one knows how many people, and no one will probably ever know, really, how many people in Guatemala have been murdered this way by the military dictatorship established by the CIA. It's 46 years, 47 years of this. Several generations have passed during that period. And today, Guatemala is still one of the most repressive countries in the whole world in terms of political repression. Well, I mention these things because I better mention El Salvador as well, because that's a similar case. You know, the United States has backed El Salvador, that is the governments of El Salvador, whether military or conservative or Christian Democrat, over the last 10 years or more in every possible way. This has to include assistance to the military and the death squads in El Salvador. The way it works is these death squads are really military and security people who operate not officially, but in their role as security officials. In other words, they are part and parcel of the official security forces. And they get lists of people. They go out and they murder anyone who is a potential student leader, trade unionist, human rights activist, and this has resulted in these years, 10 years or so of U.S. support, in the deaths of more than 70,000 people in El Salvador alone. Well, the question I think has to be asked, why do we do these things as a country or as a society? It's no good just to stand up here and describe these things as they happen. And all of the things I'm telling you and much, much more are in books. It's all there for the learning. It only takes the reading. But the question really has to be asked, I think, why do we do these things as a country? When I was a trainee in the CIA in the 50s, as a young man, I was taught that the Soviet Union's foreign policy, its expansionism, its aggressiveness, belligerence around the world, was a direct product of its domestic system, that is, the conditions needed for the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to maintain a monopoly on political power in that country. And I think any political scientist would agree that any society's or any nation's activities abroad or foreign policy has to be a direct product or result of its domestic system. So that to answer the question of why we do these things abroad, we have to look, I think, at our system here at home. When I came back in 1987, after those 17 years without a single visit, something very special was taking place here. Do you remember what was happening in 1987? We were celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Constitution. That document that sets the rules of the game for the domestic system in the United States. It may be 200 years old. There may have been 20-odd amendments and 200 years of legislation, but it is still the basic rules of the game for the system in the United States. And as I watched that what seemed to me an orgy of self-congratulation about that document in 1987, I was reminded of a passage in one of Noam Chomsky's books. It was on Central America. It's called Turning the Tide. In that book, he has a section in which he discusses the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, where those 55 men met in total secrecy. More than 50 years passed, you know, before word one of what they said at Philadelphia got out. It was because they had to keep it all secret. It was a plot. Well, during that convention, the question arose, who really is to govern the United States? They were seeking solutions, you know, to problems in governing under the Articles of Confederation. And the question arose, who really is to govern these United States? And John Jay had the answer. John Jay, you'll remember, was the president of the Continental Congress that had fought the war for independence, and he was also first Chief Justice of the United States, of the Supreme Court. John Jay said, of course, the people who own the United States ought to govern it. And his position was adopted. The Constitution was written so that political power in the United States would be in the hands of the people who own the country. Who were those 55 men and those they represented in Philadelphia? They were the merchants, the lawyers, the bankers, landowners, slaveholders, and so forth. The elite of colonial society. They wrote the Constitution in order to preserve and enhance their personal wealth. There is a book called Toward an American Revolution, which I tell people everywhere I go could be the best $10 they would spend on a book during 4, 5, or 6 years in college or university. It's by Jerry Frazier, a PhD from UMass at Amherst. It's a story of the Constitution and where it came from, about the men who were at Philadelphia, their backgrounds, and the discussion that he was able to pick up through research, and especially the way the Constitution was crammed down the throat of the states for ratification. The only states, you know, that had any referendum on the Constitution, referendum in the sense of those few people who could vote, because the Founding Fathers, you know, had begun the Constitution with the words, "We the people of the United States," and they had the gall to write that just when they had written totally out of the political process 95% of the people. They had written out all the indentured laborers, all the men without property, all of the Native Americans, they were considered savages, all of the African Americans, because they were slaves mostly, and, of course, half the population, all the women. And so there were only 5 or 6 or perhaps 7% of Americans at that time who could even participate in the political process. But they started the Constitution, we the people of the United States. Well, the point is that this book about the Constitution points out that Rhode Island was the only state that had a referendum. And of those few people who could vote, the Constitution lost 13-1. And it probably would have lost in a majority of the other states if there had been such a type of referendum. But the point is that this was the original setting out of the rules of the game. It is the original compact between the political forces in the United States to keep the political debate as narrow as possible, and it was written in order to make these rules of the game as hard to change as possible. It is the root of the situation wherein today, when we go out to vote, and we are going to select between Republicans and Democrats, we're really only choosing between, on the one hand, usually, Tweedledum, and the other, Tweedledee, because the two parties have such narrow positions. imagination can think of many, many different ways of running the country, of having a government. But the Constitution keeps it very, very narrow, and it enshrines that very first human right in the United States to the detriment of all the others, others meaning right to education, to proper health care, and the rest. But it enshrines this one right to the accumulation and use of private property and all of the power that goes with it. It is one of the reasons why we have a domestic system, system which today is in extreme crisis. I don't think I have to go through the litany of crises that we have in these United States today. Everyone knows we have one in three in this country that is illiterate. We have the worst educational system in the whole developed world, all the industrial world. And you've all seen, I'm sure, the results of these tests that are given or the polls that are given to people in the United States as to what they know about geography or mathematics or anything else. But we also have one in three in the United States who cannot read or write. They're either totally illiterate or to the degree that they cannot function in a society based on the written word. We have one in three that's living in poverty or so close or in and out that they have no relief from want. One in three Americans don't even register to vote. And of those who do register to vote, 20% of those don't vote. That yields a situation in which only 50% of the eligible voters vote in national elections, and we have a president elected then by something like 24 to 25% of the eligible voters. There are many other crises. We know the problem of a prevention and cure for AIDS, or we have a problem of racism, which permeates our society so much, or violence of every sort. There are crises and crises and more crises in this country. And, of course, the rules of the game which have produced these crises, in my estimate, is the Constitution. And it goes back that far. But the Frazier book up here on the table, I recommend to everyone to read where the government comes from and how we have a system today that requires these types of activities abroad. How? Because if we had real peace in the world, if we had no great, great crisis like the East-West crisis in Western Europe or North-South, Persian Gulf, if these crises did not exist, there would be no justification for this huge, huge military budget, two-thirds or so, or even if it were 50%, it would be just enormous. Military budget. We wouldn't be able to justify that, or the leaders of the country would not be able to justify that. What would that mean? It would mean what everyone has been talking about, peace dividend, conversion of the economy to human purposes, to peaceful purposes. It would mean solving problems like the educational crisis, solving problems like the health crisis, where 40 million Americans don't even have health insurance. The only advanced country, the only country in the developed world that does not have a national health program. If all those military expenditures were going for human purposes, then there might be a real threat of real democracy in the United States, because then we would have an educated population. We would have people who would want to participate in the political process. People would register to vote. There would be a possibility, probably, for the formation of a second party. I sometimes make a mistake and say a third party, but it's a second party, really, or a third party, or a fourth. All kinds of things could happen. And that is why the military spending, justified falsely on foreign crises, is a way of preventing real democracy and reform of the domestic system in the United States. And it is this domestic system, then, that produces these grisly activities abroad that I have already mentioned. Well, the question arises finally at the end, what to do about this? What can all of us do if we're concerned? And that's not an easy question to answer. We have failed to stop the war. But I don't think that means that people should be so disappointed that they would not want to continue. One of the most important things I think to do is to keep mobilized. I don't know whether you have organizations here that were part of the student and youth coalition formed when the anti-war movement developed. But that was a national coalition of student and youth groups, I think of something like 28 or 30 groups, including the Progressive Student Network, Student Action Union, DSA, and a whole lot more. And I certainly hope that those groups will keep together, that keep the coalition together, and also keep the nationwide anti-war coalitions to stop the next intervention. Solidarity is certainly a very important thing to keep going. Solidarity with the FMLN in El Salvador right now, when there is a real possibility, perhaps, for a ceasefire. But the FMLN and the Salvadoran people, they need U.S. solidarity now as much as they ever did. The same applies to Nicaragua, where thanks to the Reagan-Bush administration, more than 30,000 people were killed during that Contra operation of the 1980s. You know what 30,000 people is? It is 1% of the population of Nicaragua. Imagine if 1% of the U.S. population were killed in a terrorist war. That would be 2.5 million people. One time in Madrid, I went down to the U.S. Embassy's library, and I looked up the figures for all the Americans killed in every war since the Civil War, or every military action, and it only came to about, I think, 1.3 million or something like that. And that's over more than 100 years. But in Nicaragua, in the space of 7 years, thanks to the U.S., we killed, or thanks to the Bush-Reagan administration, 1% of the population were killed. Well, it was a tragedy visit on Nicaragua, and the Nicaraguans certainly need our solidarity as well. Another thing, really, is constant study of politics and what's going on in the world. It is not enough simply to come and listen to me speak for an hour and then have a discussion, and then that's the end of it. That is why it is so important to take a look at the books and the publications, because wonderful stuff is being published. And we have to keep studying. We have to keep reading. The only way to get it is through reading. Television will not give it to us. Radio will not. The only way you get it is through reading. And nobody can keep a commitment on the long term or for the long haul without continually renewing the ideological, intellectual basis for the action that we all take. But when you talk about books, you really have to be very careful. Never must we forget, or should we forget, what Congressman Harold Velde had to say about books. This is one of Howard Zinn's jewels of research. But Howard found that Harold Velde, who was a congressman from Illinois in the 1950s when I was a university student, he was speaking in the House of Representatives, get this, in opposition to the Mobile Public Library Services for Rural America. Opposition. He said, educating Americans through the library service could bring about a change of their political attitude quicker than any other method. The basis of communism and socialistic influence is education of the people. You can find it in the Congressional Record. There's one more thing, though, really, that all of us can do, and that is to spread the truth about Bush's lies and hypocrisy on the Gulf and his bombing of Iraq back to the pre-industrial age for no reason but his own re-election and the continuation of militarism in the United States. And when he does run for re-election, we have to reject his boast that he made the world safe from Saddam Hussein. And we must eject him from the White House in order to make the world safe from George Bush. Thank you very much for coming.